It is this ray which has enabled them to so perfect aviation that battleships, far outweighing anything known upon Earth, sail as gracefully and lightly through the thin air of Barsoom as a toy balloon in the heavy atmosphere of Earth. During the early years of the discovery of this ray, many strange accidents occurred before the Martians learned to measure and control the wonderful power they had found. In one instance, some 900 years before, the first great battleship to be built with eighth ray reservoirs was stored with too great a quantity of the rays, and she had sailed up from Helium with 500 officers and men, never to return. Her power of repulsion for the planet was so great that it had carried her far into space, where she can be seen today, by the aid of powerful telescopes, hurtling through the heavens 10,000 miles from Mars, a tiny satellite that will thus encircle Barsoom to the end of time. The fourth day after my arrival at Sadanga, I made my first flight, and as a result of it, I won a promotion which included quarters in the palace of Thon Kosis. As I rose above the city, I circled several times, as I had seen Kanto's Khan do, and then throwing my engine into top speed, I raced at terrific velocity toward the south, following one of the great waterways which enter Zodanga from that direction. I had traversed perhaps 200 miles in a little less than an hour when I descried far below me a party of three green warriors racing madly toward a small figure on foot which seemed to be trying to reach the confines of one of the walled fields. Dropping my machine rapidly toward them and circling to the rear of the warriors, I soon saw that the object of their pursuit was a red Martian wearing the medal of the scout squadron to which I was attached. A short distance away lay his tiny flyer, surrounded by the tools with which he had evidently been occupied in repairing some damage when surprised by the green warriors. They were now almost upon him, their flying mounts charging down on the relatively puny figure at terrific speed, while the warriors leaned low to the right with their great metal-shod spears. Each seemed striving to be the first to impale the poor Zodangan, and in another moment his fate would have been sealed had it not been for my timely arrival. Driving my fleet aircraft at high speed directly behind the warriors, I soon overtook them, and without diminishing my speed, I rammed the prow of my little flyer between the shoulders of the nearest. The impact, sufficient to have torn through inches of solid steel, hurled the fellow's headless body into the air over the head of his thoat, where it fell sprawling upon the moss. The mounts of the other two warriors turned squealing in terror and bolted in opposite directions. Reducing my speed, I circled and came to the ground at the feet of the astonished Zodangan. He was so warm in his thanks for my timely aid, and promised that my day's work would bring the reward it merited, for it was none other than a cousin of the Jeddak of Zodanga whose life I had saved. We wasted no time in talk, as we knew that the warriors would surely return as soon as they had gained control of their mounts. Hastening to his damaged machine, we were bending every effort to finish the needed repairs, and had almost completed them when we saw the two green monsters returning at top speed from opposite sides of us. When they had approached within 100 yards, their throats again became unmanageable, and absolutely refused to advance further toward the aircraft which had frightened them. The warriors finally dismounted, and hobbling their animals, advanced toward us on foot with drawn long swords. I advanced to meet the larger, telling the Zodangan to do the best he could with the other. Finishing my man with almost no effort, as had now from much practice become habitual with me, I hastened to return to my new acquaintance, whom I found, indeed, in desperate straits. He was wounded and down, with the huge foot of his antagonist upon his throat, and the great long sword raised to deal the final thrust. With a bound I cleared the 50 feet intervening between us, and with outstretched point drove my sword completely through the body of the green warrior. His sword fell harmless to the ground, and he sank limply upon the prostrate form of the Zodangan. A cursory examination of the latter revealed no mortal injuries, and after a brief rest he asserted that he felt fit to attempt the return voyage. He would have to pilot his own craft, however, as these frail vessels are not intended to convey but a single person. Quickly completing the repairs, we rose together into the still, cloudless Martian sky, and at great speed and without further mishap returned to Zodanga. As we neared the city, we discovered a mighty concourse of civilians and troops assembled upon the plain before the city. The sky was black with naval vessels and private and public pleasure craft flying long streamers of gay-colored silks and banners and flags of odd and picturesque design. My companion signaled that I slow down, and running his machine close beside me, suggested that we approach and watch the ceremony, which, he said, was for the purpose of conferring honors on individual officers and men for bravery and other distinguished service. He then unfurled a little ensign which denoted that his craft bore a member of the royal family of Zodanga, and together we made our way through the maze of low-flying air vessels until we hung directly over the jeddak of Zodanga and his staff. All were mounted upon the small domestic bull-thoats of the Red Martians, and their trappings and ornamentation bore such a quantity of gorgeously colored feathers that I could not but be struck with the startling resemblance the concourse bore to a band of the Red Indians of my own earth. One of the staff called the attention of Thon Kosas to the presence of my companion above them, and the ruler motioned for him to descend. As they waited for the troops to move into position facing the jeddak, the two talked earnestly together, the jeddak and his staff occasionally glancing up at me. I could not hear their conversation, and presently it ceased and all dismounted, as the last body of troops had wheeled into position before their emperor. A member of the staff advanced toward the troops, and calling the name of a soldier, commanded him to advance. The officer then recited the nature of the heroic act which had won the approval of the jeddak, and the latter advanced and placed a metal ornament upon the left arm of the lucky man. 10 men had been so decorated when the aide called out, "John Carter, Air Scout." Never in my life had I been so surprised, but the habit of military discipline is strong within me, and I dropped my little machine lightly to the ground and advanced on foot as I had seen the others do. As I halted before the officer, he addressed me in a voice audible to the entire assemblage of troops and spectators. "In recognition, John Carter," he said, "of your remarkable courage and skill in defending the person of the cousin of the jeddak Thon Kosas and single-handed vanquishing 3 green warriors, it is the pleasure of our jeddak to confer on you the mark of his esteem." Thon Kosas then advanced toward me, and placing an ornament upon me, said, "My cousin has narrated the details of your wonderful achievement, which seems little short of miraculous, and if you can so well defend the cousin of the jeddak, how much better could you defend the person of the jeddak himself? You are therefore appointed a padwar of the gods, and will be quartered in my palace hereafter." I thanked him, and at his direction joined the members of his staff. After the ceremony, I returned my machine to its quarters on the roof of the barracks of the Air Scout Squadron, and with an orderly from the palace to guide me, I reported to the officer in charge of the palace. Chapter 22. I Find Dasia. The Major Domo to whom I reported had been given instructions to station me near the person of the jeddak, who, in time of war, is always in great danger of assassination, as the rule that all is fair in war seems to constitute the entire ethics of Martian conflict. He therefore escorted me immediately to the apartment in which Thon Kosas then was. The ruler was engaged in conversation with his son, Sabthon, and several courtiers of his household, and did not perceive my entrance. The walls of the apartment were completely hung with splendid tapestries which hid any windows or doors which may have pierced them. The room was lighted by imprisoned rays of sunshine held between the ceiling proper and what appeared to be a ground-glass false ceiling a few inches below. My guide drew aside one of the tapestries, disclosing a passage which encircled the room between the hangings and the walls of the chamber. "Within this passage I was to remain," he said, "so long as Thon Kosas was in the apartment. When he left, I was to follow. My only duty was to guard the ruler and keep out of sight as much as possible. I would be relieved after a period of 4 hours. The majordomo then left me. The tapestries were of a strange weaving which gave the appearance of heavy solidity from one side, but from my hiding place I could perceive all that took place within the room as readily as though there had been no curtain intervening. Scarcely had I gained my post than the tapestry at the opposite end of the chamber separated and 4 soldiers of the guard entered, surrounding a female figure. As they approached Thoncosis, the soldiers fell to either side, and there, standing before the jeddak, and not 10 feet from me, her beautiful face radiant with smiles, was Dejah Thoris. Sabthan, Prince of Zardanga, advanced to meet her, and hand in hand they approached close to the jeddak. Thoncosis looked up in surprise, and rising, saluted her.
To what strange freak do I owe this visit from the Princess of Helium, who, 2 days ago, with rare consideration for my pride, assured me that she would prefer Talhadjus, the Green Thark, to my son?
Dejah Thoris only smiled the more, and with the roguish dimples playing at the corners of her mouth, she made answer.
From the beginning of time upon Barsoom, it has been the prerogative of woman to change her mind as she listed, and to dissemble in matters concerning her heart. That you will forgive, Thoncosis, as has your son. 2 days ago I was not sure of his love for me, but now I am, and I have come to beg of you to forget my rash words, and to accept the assurance of the Princess of Helium that when the time comes she will wed Sabthan, Prince of Zardanga.
I am glad that you have so decided, replied Thoncosis. It is far from my desire to push war further against the people of Helium, and your promise shall be recorded, and a proclamation to my people issued forthwith.
It were better, Thoncosis, interrupted Dejah Thoris, that the proclamation wait the ending of this war. It would look strange indeed to my people and to yours were the Princess of Helium to give herself to her country's enemy in the midst of hostilities.
Cannot the war be ended at once? Spoke Sabthan. It requires but the word of Thoncosis to bring peace. Say it, my father. Say the word that will hasten my happiness and end this unpopular strife.
We shall see, replied Thoncosis, how the people of Helium take to peace. I shall at least offer it to them.
Dejah Thoris, after a few words, turned and left the apartment, still followed by her guards. Thus was the edifice of my brief dream of happiness dashed, broken to the ground of reality. The woman for whom I had offered my life, and from whose lips I had so recently heard a declaration of love for me, had lightly forgotten my very existence, and smilingly given herself to the son of her people's most hated enemy. Although I had heard it with my own ears, I could not believe it. I must search out her apartments and force her to repeat the cruel truth to me alone before I would be convinced, and so I deserted my post and hastened through the passage behind the tapestries toward the door by which she had left the chamber. Slipping quietly through this opening, I discovered a maze of winding corridors, branching and turning in every direction. Running rapidly down first one and then another of them, I soon became hopelessly lost and was standing panting against a side wall when I heard voices near me. Apparently they were coming from the opposite side of the partition against which I leaned, and presently I made out the tones of Dejah Thoris. I could not hear the words, but I knew that I could not possibly be mistaken in the voice. Moving on a few steps, I discovered another passageway at the end of which lay a door. Walking boldly forward, I pushed into the room, only to find myself in a small antechamber, in which were the 4 guards who had accompanied her. One of them instantly arose and accosted me, asking the nature of my business. "I am from Thoncosis," I replied, "and wish to speak privately with Dejah Thoris, Princess of Helium."
"And your order?" asked the fellow.
I did not know what he meant, but replied that I was a member of the guard, and without waiting for a reply from him, I strode toward the opposite door of the antechamber,
behind which I could hear Dejathoris conversing. But my entrance was not to be so easily accomplished. The guardsman stepped before me, saying,
"No one comes from Thonkosis without carrying an order or the password. You must give me one or the other before you may pass."
"The only order I require, my friend, to enter where I will, hangs at my side," I answered, tapping my longsword. "Will you let me pass in peace or no?" For reply, he whipped out his own sword, calling to the others to join him, and thus the four stood, with drawn weapons, barring my further progress.
"You are not here by the order of Thonkosis," cried the one who had first addressed me, "and not only shall you not enter the apartments of the Princess of Helium, but you shall go back to Thonkosis under guard to explain this unwarranted temerity. Throw down your sword. You cannot hope to overcome four of us," he added with a grim smile.
My reply was a quick thrust, which left me but three antagonists, and I can assure you that they were worthy of my mettle. They had me backed against the wall in no time, fighting for my life. Slowly I worked my way to a corner of the room where I could force them to come at me only one at a time, and thus we fought upward of 20 minutes, the clanging of steel on steel producing a veritable bedlam in the little room. The noise had brought Dejathoris to the door of her apartment, and there she stood throughout the conflict with Sola at her back peering over her shoulder. Her face was set and emotionless, and I knew that she did not recognize me, nor did Sola. Finally, a lucky cut brought down a second guardsman, and then, with only two opposing me, I changed my tactics and rushed them down after the fashion of my fighting that had won me many a victory. The third fell within 10 seconds after the second, and the last lay dead upon the bloody floor a few moments later. They were brave men and noble fighters, and it grieved me that I had been forced to kill them, but I would have willingly depopulated all Barsoom could I have reached the side of my Dejathoris in no other way. Sheathing my bloody blade, I advanced toward my Martian princess, who still stood mutely gazing at me without sign of recognition.
"Who are you, Zodangan?" she whispered. "Another enemy to harass me in my misery?"
"I am a friend," I answered, "a once cherished friend."
"No friend of Helium's princess wears that metal," she replied. "And yet the voice, I have heard it before. It is not, it cannot be. No, for he is dead."
"It is, though, my princess, none other than John Carter," I said. "Do you not recognize, even through paint and strange metal, the heart of your chieftain?" As I came close to her, she swayed toward me with outstretched hands, but as I reached to take her in my arms, she drew back with a shudder and a little moan of misery.
"Too late, too late," she grieved. "Oh, my chieftain that was, and whom I thought dead, had you but returned one little hour before. But now it is too late, too late."
"What do you mean, Dejathoris?" I cried, "that you would not have promised yourself to the Zodangan prince had you known that I lived?"
"Think you, John Carter, that I would give my heart to you yesterday, and today to another? I thought that it lay buried with your ashes in the pits of Wahoon, and so today I have promised my body to another to save my people from the curse of a victorious Zodangan army."
"But I am not dead, my princess. I have come to claim you, and all Zodanga cannot prevent it."
"It is too late, John Carter. My promise is given, and on Barsoom that is final. The ceremonies which follow later are but meaningless formalities. They make the fact of marriage no more certain than does the funeral cortege of a Jeddak again place the seal of death upon him. I am as good as married, John Carter. No longer may you call me your princess. No longer are you my chieftain."
"I know but little of your customs here upon Barsoom, Dejathoris, but I do know that I love you, and if you meant the last words you spoke to me that day as the hordes of Wahoon were charging down upon us, no other man shall ever claim you as his bride. You meant them then, my princess, and you mean them still. Say that it is true."
"I meant them, John Carter," she whispered. I cannot repeat them now, for I have given myself to another. Ah, if you had only known our ways, my friend, she continued, half to herself. The promise would have been yours long months ago, and you could have claimed me before all others. It might have meant the fall of Helium, but I would have given my empire for my Thakian chief.
Then aloud she said,
Do you remember the night when you offended me? You called me your princess without having asked my hand of me, and then you boasted that you had fought for me. You did not know, and I should not have been offended. I see that now. But there was no one to tell you what I could not, that upon Barsoom there are two kinds of women in the cities of the Red Men, the one they fight for, that they may ask them in marriage, the other kind they fight for also, but never ask their hands. When a man has won a woman, he may address her as his princess, or in any of the several terms which signify possession. You had fought for me, but had never asked me in marriage, and so, when you called me your princess, you see, she faltered. I was hurt, but even then, John Carter, I did not repulse you, as I should have done, until you made it doubly worse by taunting me with having won me through combat.
I do not need ask your forgiveness now, Dejathoros, I cried. You must know that my fault was of ignorance of your Barsoomian customs. What I failed to do, through implicit belief that my petition would be presumptuous and unwelcome, I do now, Dejathoros. I ask you to be my wife, and by all the Virginian fighting blood that flows in my veins, you shall be.
No, John Carter, it is useless, she cried hopelessly. I may never be yours while Sapthan lives.
You have sealed his death warrant, my princess. Sapthan dies.
Nor that either, she hastened to explain. I may not wed the man who slays my husband, even in self-defense. It is custom. We are ruled by custom upon Barsoom. It is useless, my friend. You must bear the sorrow with me. That at least we may share in common. That, and the memory of the brief days among the Tharks. You must go now, nor ever see me again. Goodbye, my chieftain that was.
Disheartened and dejected, I withdrew from the room. But I was not entirely discouraged, nor would I admit that Dejathoros was lost to me until the ceremony had actually been performed. As I wandered along the corridors, I was as absolutely lost in the mazes of winding passageways as I had been before I discovered Dejathoros's apartments. I knew that my only hope lay in escape from the city of Zadanga, for the matter of the four dead guardsmen would have to be explained, and as I could never reach my original post without a guide, suspicion would surely rest on me so soon as I was discovered wandering aimlessly through the palace. Presently I came upon a spiral runway leading to a lower floor, and this I followed downward for several stories until I reached the doorway of a large apartment in which were a number of guardsmen. The walls of this room were hung with transparent tapestries, behind which I secreted myself without being apprehended. The conversation of the guardsmen was general, and awakened no interest in me until an officer entered the room and ordered four of the men to relieve the detail who were guarding the Princess of Helium. Now I knew my troubles would commence in earnest, and indeed they were upon me all too soon, for it seemed that the squad had scarcely left the guardroom before one of their number burst in again breathlessly, crying that they had found their four comrades butchered in the antechamber. In a moment the entire palace was alive with people, guardsmen, officers, courtiers, servants, and slaves ran helter-skelter through the corridors and apartments carrying messages and orders and searching for signs of the assassin. This was my opportunity, and slim as it appeared, I grasped it, for as a number of soldiers came hurrying past my hiding place, I fell in behind them and followed through the mazes of the palace until, in passing through a great hall, I saw the blessed light of day coming in through a series of larger windows. Here I left my guides, and slipping to the nearest window, sought for an avenue of escape. The windows opened upon a great balcony which overlooked one of the broad avenues of Zadanga. The ground was about 30 feet below, and at a like distance from the building was a wall fully 20 feet high, constructed of polished glass about a foot in thickness. To a red Martian, escape by this path would have appeared impossible, but to me, with my earthly strength and agility, it seemed already accomplished. My only fear was in being detected before darkness fell, for I could not make the leap in broad daylight while the court below and the avenue beyond were crowded with Zodangans. Accordingly, I searched for a hiding place and finally found one by accident inside a huge hanging ornament which hung from the ceiling of the hall and about 10 feet from the floor. Into the capacious bowl-like vase I sprang with ease, and scarcely had I settled down within it than I heard a number of people enter the apartment. The group stopped beneath my hiding-place, and I could plainly overhear their every word.
"It is the work of Heliumites," said one of the men.
"Yes, Sojedak, but how had they access to the palace? I could believe that even with the diligent care of your guardsmen, a single enemy might reach the inner chambers. But how a force of 6 or 8 fighting men could have done so unobserved is beyond me. We shall soon know, however, for here comes the royal psychologist."
Another man now joined the group, and after making his formal greetings to his ruler, said,
"Almighty Jeddak, it is a strange tale that I read in the dead minds of your faithful guardsmen. They were felled not by a number of fighting men, but by a single opponent."
He paused to let the full weight of this announcement impress his hearers, and that his statement was scarcely credited was evidenced by the impatient exclamation of incredulity which escaped the lips of Than Kosas.
"What manner of weird tale are you bringing me, Notan?" he cried.
"It is the truth, my Jeddak," replied the psychologist. "In fact, the impressions were strongly marked on the brain of each of the 4 guardsmen. Their antagonist was a very tall man, wearing the metal of one of your own guardsmen, and his fighting ability was little short of marvelous, for he fought fair against the entire 4, and vanquished them by his surpassing skill and superhuman strength and endurance. Though he wore the metal of Zodanga, my Jeddak, such a man was never seen before in this or any other country upon Barsoom. The princess of Helium, whom I have examined and questioned, was blank to me. She has perfect control, and I could not read one iota of it. She said that she witnessed a portion of the encounter, and that when she looked, there was but one man engaged with the guardsmen, a man whom she did not recognize as ever having seen."
"Where is my erstwhile savior?"
spoke another of the party, and I recognized the voice of the cousin of Than Kosas, whom I had rescued from the green warriors.
"By the metal of my first ancestor," he went on, "but the description fits him to perfection, especially as to his fighting ability."
"Where is this man?" cried Than Kosas. "Have him brought to me at once. What know you of him, cousin? It seems strange to me, now that I think upon it, that there should have been such a fighting man in Zodanga, of whose name, even, as we were ignorant before today. And his name, too, John Carter. Who ever heard of such a name upon Barsoom?"
Word was soon brought that I was nowhere to be found, either in the palace or at my former quarters in the barracks of the Air Scout Squadron. Kantos Khan they had found and questioned, but he knew nothing of my whereabouts, and as to my past, he had told them he knew as little, since he had but recently met me during our captivity among the Wahoons.
"Keep your eyes on this other one," commanded Than Kosas. "He is also a stranger, and likely as not they both hailed from Helium, and where one is, we shall sooner or later find the other. Quadruple the air patrol, and let every man who leaves the city by air or ground be subjected to the closest scrutiny."
Another messenger now entered with word that I was still within the palace walls.
"The likeness of every person who has entered or left the palace grounds today has been carefully examined," concluded the fellow, "and no one approaches the likeness of this new Badwa of the gods, other than that which was recorded of him at the time he entered."
Then we will have him shortly, commented Thon Kosis contentedly. And in the meanwhile we will repair to the apartments of the Princess of Helium and question her in regard to the affair. She may know more than she cared to divulge to you, Notan. Come.
They left the hall, and as darkness had fallen without, I slipped lightly from my hiding place and hastened to the balcony. Few were in sight, and choosing a moment when none seemed near, I sprang quickly to the top of the glass wall, and from there to the avenue beyond the palace grounds. Chapter 3. Lost in the Sky. Without effort at concealment, I hastened to the vicinity of our quarters, where I felt sure I should find Kantos Khan. As I neared the building, I became more careful, as I judged, and rightly, that the place would be guarded. Several men in civilian metal loitered near the front entrance, and in the rear were others. My only means of reaching, unseen, the upper story where our apartments were situated was through an adjoining building, and after considerable maneuvering, I managed to attain the roof of a shop several doors away. Leaping from roof to roof, I soon reached an open window in the building where I hoped to find the Heliumite, and in another moment I stood in the room before him. He was alone and showed no surprise at my coming, saying he had expected me much earlier, as my tour of duty must have ended some time since. I saw that he knew nothing of the events of the day at the palace, and when I had enlightened him, he was all excitement. The news that Deja Thoris had promised her hand to Saab Thon filled him with dismay.
"It cannot be!" he exclaimed. "It is impossible. Why, no man in all Helium but would prefer death to the selling of our loved princess to the ruling house of Zodanga. She must have lost her mind, too, have assented to such an atrocious bargain. You, who do not know how we of Helium love the members of our ruling house, cannot appreciate the horror with which I contemplate such an unholy alliance."
"What can be done, John Carter?" he continued. "You are a resourceful man. Could you not think of some way to save Helium from this disgrace?"
"If I can come within a sword's reach of Saab Thon," I answered, "I can solve the difficulty in so far as Helium is concerned. But for personal reasons, I would prefer that another struck the blow that frees Deja Thoris." Kantos Khan eyed me narrowly before he spoke.
"You love her," he said. "Does she know it?"
"She knows it, Kantos Khan, and repulses me only because she has promised to Saab Thon." The splendid fellow sprang to his feet, and grasping me by the shoulder, raised his sword on high, exclaiming,
"And had the choice been left to me, I could not have chosen a more fitting mate for the first princess of Barsoom. Here's my hand upon your shoulder, John Carter, and my word that Saab Thon shall go out at the point of my sword for the sake of my love for Helium, for Deja Thoris, and for you. This very night I shall try to reach his quarters in the palace."
"How?" I asked. "You are strongly guarded, and a quadruple force patrols the sky." He bent his head in thought a moment, then raised it with an air of confidence.
"I only need to pass these guards, and I can do it," he said at last. "I know a secret entrance to the palace through the pinnacle of the highest tower. I fell upon it by chance one day as I was passing above the palace on patrol duty. In this work it is required that we investigate any unusual occurrence we may witness, and a face peering from the pinnacle of the high tower of the palace was, to me, most unusual. I therefore drew near and discovered that the possessor of the peering face was none other than Saab Thon. He was slightly put out at being detected and commanded me to keep the matter to myself, explaining that the passage from the tower led directly to his apartments and was known only to him. If I can reach the roof of the barracks and get my machine, I can be in Saab Thon's quarters in 5 minutes. But how am I to escape from this building, guarded as you say it is?"
"How well are the machine sheds at the barracks guarded?" I asked.
"There is usually but one man on duty there at night upon the roof."
"Go to the roof of this building, Kantos Khan, and wait me there." Without stopping to explain my plans, I retraced my way to the street and hastened to the barracks. I did not dare to enter the building, filled as it was with members of the Air Scout Squadron who, in common with all Zodanga, were on the lookout for me. The building was an enormous one, rearing its lofty head fully 1,000 feet into the air. But few buildings in Zodanga were higher than these barracks, though several topped it by a few hundred feet. The docks of the great battleships of the line standing some 1,500 feet from the ground, while the freight and passenger stations of the merchant squadrons rose nearly as high. It was a long climb up the face of the building, and one fraught with much danger. But there was no other way, and so I essayed the task. The fact that Barsoomian architecture is extremely ornate made the feat much simpler than I had anticipated, since I found ornamental ledges and projections which fairly formed a perfect ladder for me all the way to the eaves of the building. Here I met my first real obstacle. The eaves projected nearly 20 feet from the wall to which I clung, and though I encircled the great building, I could find no opening through them. The top floor was alight, and filled with soldiers engaged in the pastimes of their kind. I could not, therefore, reach the roof through the building. There was one slight, desperate chance, and that I decided I must take. It was for Dejah Thoris, and no man has lived who would not risk 1,000 deaths for such as she. Clinging to the wall with my feet and one hand, I unloosened one of the long leather straps of my trappings, at the end of which dangled a great hook by which air sailors are hung to the sides and bottoms of their craft for various purposes of repair, and by means of which landing parties are lowered to the ground from the battleships. I swung this hook cautiously to the roof several times before it finally found lodgment. Gently I pulled on it to strengthen its hold, but whether it would bear the weight of my body, I did not know. It might be barely caught upon the very outer verge of the roof, so that as my body swung out at the end of the strap, it would slip off and launch me to the pavement 1,000 feet below. An instant I hesitated, and then, releasing my grasp upon the supporting ornament, I swung out into space at the end of the strap. Far below me lay the brilliantly lighted streets, the hard pavements, and death. There was a little jerk at the top of the supporting eaves, and a nasty slipping, grating sound which turned me cold with apprehension. Then the hook caught, and I was safe. Clambering quickly aloft, I grasped the edge of the eaves and drew myself to the surface of the roof above. As I gained my feet, I was confronted by the sentry on duty, into the muzzle of whose revolver I found myself looking.
"Who are you, and whence came you?" he cried.
"I am an air scout, friend, and very near a dead one, for just by the merest chance I escaped falling to the avenue below," I replied.
"But how came you upon the roof, man? No one has landed or come up from the building for the past hour. Quick, explain yourself, or I call the guard."
"Look you here, sentry, and you shall see how I came and how close a shave I had to not come in at all," I answered, turning toward the edge of the roof, where 20 feet below, at the end of my strap, hung all my weapons. The fellow, acting on impulse of curiosity, stepped to my side and to his undoing, for as he leaned to peer over the eaves, I grasped him by the throat in his pistol arm and threw him heavily to the roof. The weapon dropped from his grasp, and my fingers choked off his attempted cry for assistance. I gagged and bound him, and then hung him over the edge of the roof, as I myself had hung a few moments before. I knew it would be morning before he would be discovered, and I needed all the time that I could gain. Donning trappings and weapons, I hastened to the sheds, and soon had out both my machine and Kantos Khan's. Making his fast behind mine, I started my engine, and skimming over the edge of the roof, I dove down into the streets of the city, far below the plain usually occupied by the air patrol. In less than a minute, I was settling safely upon the roof of our apartment beside the astonished Kantos Khan. I lost no time in explanation, but plunged immediately into a discussion of our plans for the immediate future. It was decided that I was to try to make Helium, while Kantos Khan was to enter the palace and dispatch Saab Thawne. If successful, he was then to follow me. He set my compass for me, a clever little device which will remain steadfastly fixed upon any given point of the surface of Barsoom, and bidding each other farewell, we rose together and sped in the direction of the palace, which lay in the route which I must take to reach Helium. As we neared the high tower, a patrol shot down from above, throwing its piercing searchlight full upon my craft, and a voice roared out a command to halt, following with a shot as I paid no attention to his hail. Kantos Khan dropped quickly into the darkness, while I rose steadily and at terrific speed raced through the Martian sky, followed by a dozen of the air scout craft which had joined the pursuit, and later by a swift cruiser carrying 100 men and a battery of rapid-fire guns. By twisting and turning my little machine, now rising, now falling, I managed to elude their searchlights most of the time, but I was also losing ground by these tactics, and so I decided to hazard everything on a straightaway course and leave the result to fate and the speed of my machine. Kantos Khan had shown me a trick of gearing, which is known only to the Navy of Helium, that greatly increased the speed of our machines, so that I felt sure I could distance my pursuers if I could dodge their projectiles for a few moments. As I sped through the air, the screeching of the bullets around me convinced me that only by a miracle could I escape. But the die was cast, and throwing on full speed, I raced a straight course toward Helium. Gradually, I left my pursuers further and further behind, and I was just congratulating myself on my lucky escape when a well-directed shot from the cruiser exploded at the prow of my little craft. The concussion nearly capsized her, and with a sickening plunge, she hurtled downward through the dark night. How far I fell before I regained control of the plane, I do not know. But I must have been very close to the ground when I started to rise again, as I plainly heard the squealing of animals below me. Rising again, I scanned the heavens for my pursuers, and finally making out their lights far behind me, saw that they were landing, evidently in search of me. Not until their lights were no longer discernible did I venture to flash my little lamp upon my compass, and then I found to my consternation that a fragment of the projectile had utterly destroyed my only guide, as well as my speedometer. It was true I could follow the stars in the general direction of Helium, but without knowing the exact location of the city or the speed at which I was traveling, my chances of finding it were slim. Helium lies 1,000 miles southwest of Zadanga, and with my compass intact, I should have made the trip, barring accidents, in between 4 and 5 hours. As it turned out, however, morning found me speeding over a vast expanse of Dead Sea bottom after nearly 6 hours of continuous flight at high speed. Presently, a great city showed below me, but it was not Helium, as that alone of all Barsoomian metropolises consists in 2 immense circular-walled cities about 75 miles apart, and would have been easily distinguishable from the altitude at which I was flying. Believing that I had come too far to the north and west, I turned back in a southeasterly direction, passing during the forenoon several other large cities, but none resembling the description which Kantos Khan had given me of Helium. In addition to the twin city formation of Helium, another distinguishing feature is the 2 immense towers, one of vivid scarlet rising nearly 1 mile into the air from the center of one of the cities, while the other, of bright yellow and of the same height, marks her sister. Chapter 4. Tars Tarkas Finds a Friend. About noon I passed low over a great dead city of ancient Mars, and as I skimmed out across the plain beyond, I came full upon several thousand green warriors engaged in a terrific battle. Scarcely had I seen them than a volley of shots was directed at me, and with the almost unfailing accuracy of their aim, my little craft was instantly a ruined wreck, sinking erratically to the ground. I fell almost directly in the center of the fierce combat, among warriors who had not seen my approach so busily were they engaged in life-and-death struggles. The men were fighting on foot with long swords, while an occasional shot from a sharpshooter on the outskirts of the conflict would bring down a warrior who might for an instant separate himself from the entangled mass. As my machine sank among them, I realized that it was fight or die, with good chances of dying in any event, and so I struck the ground with drawn long sword ready to defend myself as I could. I fell beside a huge monster who was engaged with three antagonists, and as I glanced at his fierce face, filled with the light of battle, I recognized Taz Tarkus the Thark. He did not see me, as I was a trifle behind him, and just then the three warriors opposing him, and whom I recognized as Wahoons, charged simultaneously. The mighty fellow made quick work of one of them, but in stepping back for another thrust, he fell over a dead body behind him and was down and at the mercy of his foes in an instant. Quick as lightning they were upon him, and Taz Tarkus would have been gathered to his fathers in short order had I not sprung before his prostrate form and engaged his adversaries. I had accounted for one of them when the mighty Thark regained his feet and quickly settled the other. He gave me one look, and a slight smile touched his grim lip, as, touching my shoulder, he said, "I would scarcely recognize you, John Carter, but there is no other mortal upon Barsoom who would have done what you have for me. I think I have learned that there is such a thing as friendship, my friend." He said no more, nor was there opportunity, for the Wahoons were closing in about us, and together we fought, shoulder to shoulder, during all that long hot afternoon, until the tide of battle turned, and the remnant of the fierce Wahoon horde fell back upon their thoats and fled into the gathering darkness. 10,000 men had been engaged in that titanic struggle, and upon the field of battle lay 3,000 dead. Neither side asked or gave quarter, nor did they attempt to take prisoners. On our return to the city after the battle, we had gone directly to Taz Tarkus's quarters, where I was left alone while the chieftain attended the customary council which immediately follows an engagement. As I sat, awaiting the return of the green warrior, I heard something move in an adjoining apartment, and as I glanced up, there rushed suddenly upon me a huge and hideous creature which bore me backward upon the pile of silks and furs upon which I had been reclining. It was Wooler. Faithful love and Wooler. He had found his way back to Thark, and, as Taz Tarkus later told me, had gone immediately to my former quarters, where he had taken up his pathetic and seemingly hopeless watch for my return.
"Tal-Hajus knows you are here, John Carter," said Taz Tarkus on his return from the Jeddak's quarters. "Sarkoja saw and recognized you as we were returning. Tal-Hajus has ordered me to bring you before him tonight. I have 10 thoughts, John Carter. You may take your choice from among them, and I will accompany you to the nearest waterway that leads to Helium. Taz Tarkus may be a cruel green warrior, but he can be a friend as well. Come, we must start."
"And when you return, Taz Tarkus?" I asked.
"The wild Kalits, possibly, or worse," he replied. "Unless I should chance to have the opportunity I have so long waited of battling with Tal-Hajus."
"We will stay, Taz Tarkus, and see Tal-Hajus tonight. You shall not sacrifice yourself, and it may be that tonight you can have the chance you wait." He objected strenuously, saying that Tal-Hajus often flew into wild fits of passion at the mere thought of the blow I had dealt him, and that if ever he laid his hands upon me, I would be subjected to the most horrible tortures. While we were eating, I repeated to Taz Tarkus the story which Sola had told me that night upon the sea bottom during the march to Thark. He said but little, but the great muscles of his face worked in passion and in agony at recollection of the horrors which had been heaped upon the only thing he had ever loved in all his cold, cruel, terrible existence. He no longer demurred when I suggested that we go before Tauhagis, only saying that he would like to speak to Sarkoja first. At his request, I accompanied him to her quarters, and the look of venomous hatred she cast upon me was almost adequate to recompense for any future misfortunes this accidental return to Thark might bring me.
"Sarkoja," said Tars Tarkas, 40 years ago you were instrumental in bringing about the torture and death of a woman named Gozava. I have just discovered that the warrior who loved that woman has learned of your part in the transaction. He may not kill you, Sarkoja. It is not our custom. But there is nothing to prevent him tying one end of a strap about your neck and the other end to a wild thought, merely to test your fitness to survive and help perpetuate our race. Having heard that he would do this on the morrow, I thought it only right to warn you, for I am just a man. The river Iss is but a short pilgrimage, Sarkoja. Come, John Carter.
The next morning Sarkoja was gone, nor was she ever seen after. In silence we hastened to the Jeddak's palace, where we were immediately admitted to his presence. In fact, he could scarcely wait to see me, and was standing erect upon his platform glowering at the entrance as I came in.
"Strap him to that pillar," he shrieked. "We shall see who it is dares strike the mighty Tauhagis. Heat the irons. With my own hands I shall burn the eyes from his head, that he may not pollute my person with his vile gaze."
"Chieftains of Thark," I cried, turning to the assembled council and ignoring Tauhagis, "I have been a chief among you, and today I have fought for Thark shoulder to shoulder with her greatest warrior. You owe me, at least, a hearing. I have won that much today. You claim to be just people."
"Silence!" roared Tauhagis. "Gag the creature, and bind him as I command."
"Justice, Tauhagis!" exclaimed Lorcus Tomal. "Who are you to set aside the customs of ages among the Tharks?"
"Yes, justice!" echoed a dozen voices,
and so, while Tauhagis fumed in froth, I continued. "You are a brave people, and you love bravery. But where was your mighty Jeddak during the fighting today?
I did not see him in the thick of battle.
He was not there. He rends defenseless women and little children in his lair. But how recently has one of you seen him fight with men? Why, even I, a midget beside him, felled him with a single blow of my fist. Is it of such that the Tharks fashion their Jeddaks? There stands beside me now a great Thark, a mighty warrior, and a noble man. Chieftains, how sounds Tars Tarkas, Jeddak of Thark?" A roar of deep-toned applause greeted this suggestion. "It but remains for this council to command, and Tauhagis must prove his fitness to rule. Were he a brave man, he would invite Tars Tarkas to combat, for he does not love him. But Tauhagis is afraid. Tauhagis, your Jeddak, is a coward. With my bare hands I could kill him, and he knows it." After I ceased, there was tense silence, as all eyes were riveted upon Tauhagis. He did not speak or move, but the blotchy green of his countenance turned livid, and the froth froze upon his lips.
"Tauhagis," said Lorcus Tomal in a cold, hard voice, "never in my long life have I seen a Jeddak of the Thark so humiliated. There could be but one answer to this arraignment. We waited."
And still Tauhagis stood as though electrified.
"Chieftains," continued Lorcus Tomal, "shall the Jeddak Tauhagis prove his fitness to rule over Tars Tarkas?"
There were 20 chieftains about the rostrum, and 20 swords flashed high in assent. There was no alternative. That decree was final, and so Tauhagis drew his longsword and advanced to meet Tars Tarkas. The combat was soon over, and with his foot upon the neck of the dead monster, Tars Tarkas became Jeddak among the Tharks. His first act was to make me a full-fledged chieftain, with the rank I had won by my combats the first few weeks of my captivity among them. Seeing the favorable disposition of the warriors towards Tars Tarkas, as well as toward me, I grasped the opportunity to enlist them in my cause against Adanga. I told Tars Tarkas the story of my adventures, and in a few words had explained to him the thought I had in mind.
John Carter has made a proposal, he said, addressing the council, which meets with my sanction. I shall put it to you briefly. Deja Thoris, the Princess of Helium, who was our prisoner, is now held by the Jeddak of Zodanga, whose son she must wed to save her country from devastation at the hands of the Zodangan forces. John Carter suggests that we rescue her and return her to Helium. The loot of Zodanga would be magnificent, and I have often thought that had we an alliance with the people of Helium, we could obtain sufficient assurance of sustenance to permit us to increase the size and frequency of our hatchings, and thus become unquestionably supreme among the green men of all Barsoom. What say you?
It was a chance to fight, an opportunity to loot, and they rose to the bait as a speckled trout to a fly. For Thox they were wildly enthusiastic, and before another half hour had passed, 20-mounted messengers were speeding across Dead Sea bottoms to call the hordes together for the expedition. In 3 days we were on the march towards Odanga, 100,000 strong, as Tars Tarkas had been able to enlist the services of 3 smaller hordes on the promise of the great loot of Zodanga. At the head of the column, I rode beside the great Thark, while at the heels of my mount trotted my beloved Wulla. We traveled entirely by night, timing our marches so that we camped during the day at deserted cities where, even to the beast, we were all kept indoors during the daylight hours. On the march, Tars Tarkas, through his remarkable ability and statesmanship, enlisted 50,000 more warriors from various hordes, so that, 10 days after we set out, we halted at midnight outside the great walled city of Zodanga, 150,000 strong. The fighting strength and efficiency of this horde of ferocious green monsters was equivalent to 10 times their number of red men. Never in the history of Barsoom, Tars Tarkas told me, had such a force of green warriors marched to battle together. It was a monstrous task to keep even a semblance of harmony among them, and it was a marvel to me that he got them to the city without a mighty battle among themselves. But as we neared Zodanga, their personal quarrels were submerged by their greater hatred for the red men, and especially for the Zodangans, who had for years waged a ruthless campaign of extermination against the green men, directing special attention toward despoiling their incubators. Now that we were before Zodanga, the task of obtaining entry to the city devolved upon me, and directing Tars Tarkas to hold his forces in 2 divisions out of earshot of the city, with each division opposite a large gateway, I took 20 dismounted warriors and approached one of the small gates that pierced the walls at short intervals. These gates have no regular guard, but are covered by sentries who patrolled the avenue that encircles the city just within the walls as our metropolitan police patrol their beats. The walls of Zodanga are 75 feet in height and 50 feet thick. They are built of enormous blocks of carborundum, and the task of entering the city seemed, to my escort of green warriors, an impossibility. The fellows who had been detailed to accompany me were of one of the smaller hordes, and therefore did not know me. Placing 3 of them with their faces to the wall and arms locked, I commanded 2 more to mount to their shoulders, and a 6th I ordered to climb upon the shoulders of the upper 2. The head of the topmost warrior towered over 40 feet from the ground. In this way, with 10 warriors, I built a series of 3 steps from the ground to the shoulders of the topmost man. Then, starting from a short distance behind them, I ran swiftly up from 1 tier to the next, and with a final bound from the broad shoulders of the highest, I clutched the top of the great wall
and quietly drew myself to its broad expanse. After me, I dragged 6 links of leather from an equal number of my warriors. These links we had previously fastened together, and passing one end to the topmost warrior, I lowered the other end cautiously over the opposite side of the wall toward the avenue below. No one was in sight, so, lowering myself to the end of my leather strap, I dropped the remaining 30 feet to the pavement below. I had learned from Kantos Khan the secret of opening these gates, and in another moment my 20 great fighting men stood within the doomed city of Zodanga. I found to my delight that I had entered at the lower boundary of the enormous palace grounds. The building itself showed in the distance a blaze of glorious light, and on the instant I determined to lead a detachment of warriors directly within the palace itself, while the balance of the great horde was attacking the barracks of the soldiery. Dispatching one of my men to Tars Tarkas for a detail of 50 thoks, with word of my intentions, I ordered 10 warriors to capture and open one of the great gates, while, with the 9 remaining, I took the other. We were to do our work quietly, no shots were to be fired, and no general advance made until I had reached the palace with my 50 thoks. Our plans worked to perfection. The 2 sentries we met were dispatched to their fathers upon the banks of the lost Sea of Chorus, and the guards at both gates followed them in silence. Chapter 25. The Looting of Zodanga. As the great gate where I stood swung open, my 50 thoks, headed by Tars Tarkas himself, rode in upon their mighty thoats. I led them to the palace walls, which I negotiated easily without assistance. Once inside, however, the gate gave me considerable trouble, but I finally was rewarded by seeing it swing open upon its huge hinges, and soon my fierce escort was riding across the gardens of the Jeddak of Zodanga. As we approached the palace, I could see through the great windows of the first floor into the brilliantly illuminated audience chamber of Thon Khosis. The immense hall was crowded with nobles and their women, as though some important function was in progress. There was not a god in sight without the palace, due, I presume, to the fact that the city and palace walls were considered impregnable, and so I came close and peered within. At one end of the chamber, upon massive golden thrones encrusted with diamonds, sat Thon Khosis and his consort, surrounded by officers and dignitaries of state. Before them stretched a broad aisle lined on either side with soldiery, and as I looked, there entered this aisle at the far end of the hall the head of a procession which advanced to the foot of the throne. First there marched 4 officers of the Jeddak's guard, bearing a huge salver on which reposed, upon a cushion of scarlet silk, a great golden chain with a collar, and padlock at each end. Directly behind these officers came 4 others, carrying a similar salver which supported the magnificent ornaments of a prince and princess of the reigning house of Zodanga. At the foot of the throne these 2 parties separated and halted, facing each other at opposite sides of the aisle. Then came more dignitaries, and the officers of the palace and of the army, and finally 2 figures entirely muffled in scarlet silk, so that not a feature of either was discernible. These 2 stopped at the foot of the throne, facing Thon Khosis. When the balance of the procession had entered and assumed their stations, Thon Khosis addressed the couple standing before him. I could not hear his words, but presently 2 officers advanced and removed the scarlet robe from one of the figures, and I saw that Kantos Khan had failed in his mission, for it was Sabthon, Prince of Zodanga, who stood revealed before me. Thon Khosis now took a set of the ornaments from one of the salvers and placed one of the collars of gold about his son's neck, springing the padlock fast. After a few more words addressed to Sabthon, he returned to the other figure, from which the officers now removed the enshrouding silks, disclosing to my now comprehending view Deja Thoris, Princess of Helium. The object of the ceremony was clear to me. In another moment, Deja Thoris would be joined forever to the Prince of Zodanga.
It was an impressive and beautiful ceremony, I presume, but to me it seemed the most fiendish sight I had ever witnessed, and as the ornaments were adjusted upon her beautiful figure, and her collar of gold swung open in the hands of Thonkosis, I raised my long sword above my head, and with a heavy hilt I shattered the glass of the great window, and sprang into the midst of the astonished assemblage. With a bound I was on the steps of the platform beside Thonkosis, and as he stood riveted with surprise, I brought my long sword down upon the golden chain that would have bound Dejathoris to another. In an instant, all was confusion. A thousand drawn swords menaced me from every quarter, and Sob Thon sprang upon me with a jeweled dagger he had drawn from his nuptial ornaments. I could have killed him as easily as I might a fly, but the age-old custom of Barsoom stayed my hand, and grasping his wrist as the dagger flew toward my heart, I held him as though in a vise, and with my long sword pointed to the far end of the hall. "So Danga has fallen," I cried. "Look!" All eyes turned in the direction I had indicated, and there, forging through the portals of the entranceway, rode Tars Tarkas and his 50 warriors on their great thoats. A cry of alarm and amazement broke from the assemblage, but no word of fear, and in a moment the soldiers and nobles of Zodanga were hurling themselves upon the advancing Tharks. Thrusting Sob Thon headlong from the platform, I drew Dejathoris to my side. Behind the throne was a narrow doorway, and in this Thonkosis now stood facing me, with drawn longsword. In an instant we were engaged, and I found no mean antagonist. As we circled upon the broad platform, I saw Sob Thon rushing up the steps to aid his father, but, as he raised his hand to strike, Dejathoris sprang before him, and then my sword found the spot that made Sob Thon Jeddak of Zodanga. As his father rolled dead upon the floor, the new Jeddak tore himself free from Dejathoris' grasp, and again we faced each other. He was soon joined by a quartet of officers, and, with my back against a golden throne, I fought once again for Dejathoris. I was hard-pressed to defend myself, and yet not strike down Sob Thon, and, with him, my last chance to win the woman I loved. My blade was swinging with the rapidity of lightning as I sought to parry the thrusts and cuts of my opponents. Two I had disarmed, and one was down, when several more rushed to the aid of their new ruler and to avenge the death of the old. As they advanced, there were cries of, "The woman! The woman! Strike her down! It is her plot! Kill her! Kill her!" Calling to Dejathoris to get behind me, I worked my way toward the little doorway back of the throne, but the officers realized my intentions, and three of them sprang in behind me and blocked my chances for gaining a position where I could have defended Dejathoris against any army of swordsmen. The Tharks were having their hands full in the center of the room, and I began to realize that nothing short of a miracle could save Dejathoris and myself when I saw Tars Tarkas surging through the crowd of pygmies that swarmed about him. With one swing of his mighty longsword, he laid a dozen corpses at his feet, and so he hewed a pathway before him, until, in another moment, he stood upon the platform beside me, dealing death and destruction right and left. The bravery of the Zodangans was awe-inspiring. Not one attempted to escape, and when the fighting ceased, it was because only Tharks remained alive in the great hall, other than Dejathoris and myself. Sob Thon lay dead beside his father, and the corpses of the flower of Zodangan nobility and chivalry covered the floor of the bloody shambles. My first thought when the battle was over was for Kantos Khan, and leaving Dejathoris in charge of Tars Tarkas, I took a dozen warriors and hastened to the dungeons beneath the palace. The jailers had all left to join the fighters in the throne room, so we searched the labyrinthine prison without opposition. I called Kantos Khan's name aloud in each new corridor and compartment, and finally I was rewarded by hearing a faint response. Guided by the sound, we soon found him helpless in a dark recess. He was overjoyed at seeing me, and to know the meaning of the fight, faint echoes of which had reached his prison cell. He told me that the air patrol had captured him before he reached the high tower of the palace, so that he had not even seen Saab Thawne. We discovered that it would be futile to attempt to cut away the bars and chains which held him prisoner, so, at his suggestion, I returned to search the bodies on the floor above for keys to open the padlocks of his cell and of his chains. Fortunately, among the first I examined, I found his jailer, and soon we had Kantos Khan with us in the throne room. The sounds of heavy firing, mingled with shouts and cries, came to us from the city streets, and Tars Tarkas hastened away to direct the fighting without. Kantos Khan accompanied him to act as guide, the green warriors commencing a thorough search of the palace for other Sodongans and for loot, and Dejah Thoris and I were left alone. She had sunk into one of the golden thrones, and as I turned to her, she greeted me with a wan smile.
"Was there ever such a man?" she exclaimed. "I know that Barsoom has never before seen your like. Can it be that all Earthmen are as you? Alone, a stranger, hunted, threatened, persecuted, you have done in a few short months what in all the past ages of Barsoom no man has ever done, joined together the wild hordes of the sea bottoms and brought them to fight as allies of a red Martian people."
"The answer is easy, Dejah Thoris," I replied, smiling. "It was not I who did it. It was love. Love for Dejah Thoris, a power that would work greater miracles than this you have seen." A pretty flush overspread her face, and she answered,
"You may say that now, John Carter, and I may listen, for I am free."
"And more still, I have to say, ere it is again too late," I returned. "I have done many strange things in my life, many things that wiser men would not have dared, but never in my wildest fancies have I dreamed of winning a Dejah Thoris for myself, for never had I dreamed that in all the universe dwelt such a woman as the Princess of Helium. That you are a princess does not abash me, but that you are you is enough to make me doubt my sanity as I ask you, my princess, to be mine."
"He does not need to be abashed, who so well knew the answer to his plea, before the plea were made,"
she replied, rising and placing her dear hands upon my shoulders. And so I took her in my arms and kissed her. And thus, in the midst of a city of wild conflict, filled with the alarms of war, with death and destruction reaping their terrible harvest around her, did Dejah Thoris, Princess of Helium, true daughter of Mars, the god of war, promised herself in marriage to John Carter, gentleman of Virginia. Chapter 26. Through Carnage to Joy. Sometime later, Tars Tarkas and Kantos Khan returned to report that Zodonga had been completely reduced. Her forces were entirely destroyed or captured, and no further resistance was to be expected from within. Several battleships had escaped, but there were thousands of war and merchant vessels under guard of Thark warriors. The lesser hordes had commenced looting and quarreling among themselves, so it was decided that we collect what warriors we could, man as many vessels as possible with Sodongan prisoners, and make for Helium without further loss of time. 5 hours later, we sailed from the roofs of the dock buildings with a fleet of 250 battleships, carrying nearly 100,000 green warriors, followed by a fleet of transports with our thoats. Behind us, we left the stricken city in the fierce and brutal clutches of some 40,000 green warriors of the lesser hordes. They were looting, murdering, and fighting among themselves. In 100 places they had applied the torch, and columns of dense smoke were rising above the city as though to blot out from the eye of heaven the horrid sights beneath. In the middle of the afternoon, we sighted the scarlet and yellow towers of Helium, and a short time later, a great fleet of Sodongan battleships rose from the camps of the besiegers without the city and advanced to meet us. The banners of Helium had been strung from stem to stern of each of our mighty craft, But the Sodongans did not need this sign to realize that we were enemies, for our green Martian warriors had opened fire upon them almost as they left the ground. With their uncanny marksmanship, they raked the oncoming fleet with volley after volley. The twin cities of Helium, perceiving that we were friends, sent out hundreds of vessels to aid us, and then began the first real air battle I had ever witnessed. The vessels carrying our green warriors were kept circling above the contending fleets of Helium and Zodanga, since their batteries were useless in the hands of the Thaks, who, having no navy, have no skill in naval gunnery. Their small-arm fire, however, was most effective, and the final outcome of the engagement was strongly influenced, if not wholly determined, by their presence. At first, the two forces circled at the same altitude, pouring broadside after broadside into each other. Presently, a great hole was torn in the hull of one of the immense battlecraft from the Zodongan camp. With a lurch, she turned completely over, the little figures of her crew plunging, turning and twisting toward the ground 1,000 feet below. Then with sickening velocity, she tore after them, almost completely burying herself in the soft loam of the ancient sea bottom. A wild cry of exultation arose from the Heliumite squadron, and with redoubled ferocity they fell upon the Zodongan fleet. By a pretty maneuver, two of the vessels of Helium gained a position above their adversaries, from which they poured upon them from their keel bomb batteries, a perfect torrent of exploding bombs. Then, one by one, the battleships of Helium succeeded in rising above the Zodongans, and in a short time a number of the beleaguering battleships were drifting, hopeless wrecks, toward the high scarlet tower of Great Helium. Several others attempted to escape, but they were soon surrounded by thousands of tiny individual flyers, and above each hung a monster battleship of Helium, ready to drop boarding parties upon their decks. Within but little more than an hour from the moment the victorious Zodongan squadron had risen to meet us from the camp of the besiegers, the battle was over, and the remaining vessels of the conquered Zodongans were headed toward the cities of Helium under prize crews. There was an extremely pathetic side to the surrender of these mighty flyers, the result of an age-old custom which demanded that surrender should be signalized by the voluntary plunging to earth of the commander of the vanquished vessel. One after another, the brave fellows, holding their colors high above their heads, leaped from the towering bows of their mighty craft to an awful death. Not until the commander of the entire fleet took the fearful plunge, thus indicating the surrender of the remaining vessels, did the fighting cease and the useless sacrifice of brave men come to an end. We now signaled the flagship of Helium's navy to approach, and when she was within hailing distance, I called out that we had the Princess Deja Thoris on board, and that we wished to transfer her to the flagship that she might be taken immediately to the city. As the full import of my announcement bore in upon them, a great cry arose from the decks of the flagship, and a moment later the colors of the Princess of Helium broke from 100 points upon her upper works. When the other vessels of the squadron caught the meaning of the signals flashed them, they took up the wild acclaim and unfurled her colors in the gleaming sunlight. The flagship bore down upon us, and as she swung gracefully to and touched our side, a dozen officers sprang upon our decks. As their astonished gaze fell upon the hundreds of green warriors who now came forth from the fighting shelters, they stopped aghast. But at sight of Kantos Khan, who advanced to meet them, they came forward, crowding about him. Deja Thoris and I then advanced, and they had no eyes for other than her. She received them gracefully, calling each by name, for there were men high in the esteem and service of her grandfather, and she knew them well.
"Lay your hands upon the shoulder of John Carter," she said to them, turning toward me, "the man to whom Helium owes her princess as well as her victory today."
They were very courteous to me, and said many kind and complimentary things, but what seemed to impress them most was that I had won the aid of the fierce Thaks in my campaign for the liberation of Deja Thoris and the relief of Helium. "You owe your thanks more to another man than to me," I said, "and here he is. meet one of Barsoom's greatest soldiers and statesmen, Tars Tarkas, Jeddak of Tharg. With the same polished courtesy that had marked their manner toward me, they extended their greetings to the great Tharg, nor, to my surprise, was he much behind them in ease of bearing or in courtly speech. Though not a garrulous race, the Tharks are extremely formal, and their ways lend themselves amazingly well to dignified and courtly manners. Dejah Thoris went aboard the flagship, and was much put out that I would not follow, but, as I explained to her, the battle was but partly won. We still had the land forces of the besieging Zodangans to account for, and I would not leave Tars Tarkas until that had been accomplished. The commander of the naval forces of Helium promised to arrange to have the armies of Helium attacked from the city in conjunction with our land attack, and so the vessels separated, and Dejah Thoris was borne in triumph back to the court of her grandfather, Taras Mors, Jeddak of Helium. In the distance lay our fleet of transports, with the thoats of the Green Warriors, where they had remained during the battle. Without landing stages, it was to be a difficult matter to unload these beasts upon the open plain, but there was nothing else for it, and so we put out for a point about 10 miles from the city and began the task. It was necessary to lower the animals to the ground in slings, and this work occupied the remainder of the day and half the night. Twice we were attacked by parties of Zodangan cavalry, but with little loss, however, and after darkness shut down, they withdrew. As soon as the last thoat was unloaded, Tars Tarkas gave the command to advance, and in 3 parties we crept upon the Zodangan camp from the north, the south, and the east. About a mile from the main camp, we encountered their outpost, and, as had been prearranged, accepted this as the signal to charge. With wild, ferocious cries, and amidst the nasty squealing of battle-enraged thoats, we bore down upon the Zodangans. We did not catch them napping, but found a well-entrenched battle line confronting us. Time after time we were repulsed until, toward noon, I began to fear for the result of the battle. The Zodangans numbered nearly 1 million fighting men gathered from pole to pole, wherever stretched their ribbon-like waterways, while pitted against them were less than 100,000 green warriors. The forces from Helium had not arrived, nor could we receive any word from them. Just at noon we heard heavy firing all along the line between the Zodangans and the cities, and we knew then that our much-needed reinforcements had come. Again Tars Tarkas ordered the charge, and once more the mighty thoats bore their terrible riders against the ramparts of the enemy. At the same moment the battle line of Helium surged over the opposite breastworks of the Zodangans, and in another moment they were being crushed as between 2 millstones. Nobly they fought, but in vain. The plain before the city became a veritable shambles ere the last Zodangan surrendered, but finally the carnage ceased, the prisoners were marched back to Helium, and we entered the greater city's gates, a huge triumphal procession of conquering heroes. The broad avenues were lined with women and children, among which were the few men whose duties necessitated that they remain within the city during the battle. We were greeted with an endless round of applause, and showered with ornaments of gold, platinum, silver, and precious jewels. The city had gone mad with joy. My fierce thoughts caused the wildest excitement and enthusiasm. Never before had an armed body of green warriors entered the gates of Helium, and that they came now as friends and allies filled the red men with rejoicing. That my poor services to Dejah Thoris had become known to the Heliumites was evidenced by the loud crying of my name, and by the loads of ornaments that were fastened upon me and my huge thoat as we passed up the avenues to the palace, for even in the face of the ferocious appearance of Wulla, the populace pressed close about me. As we approached the magnificent pile, we were met by a party of officers who greeted us warmly and requested the Tars Tarkas and his Jeds, with the Jeddaks and Jeds of his wild allies, together with myself, dismount and accompany them to receive from Tardus Moore an expression of his gratitude for our services. At the top of the great steps leading up to the main portals of the palace stood the royal party, and as we reached the lower steps one of their number descended to meet us. He was an almost perfect specimen of manhood. Tall, straight as an arrow, superbly muscled, and with the carriage and bearing of a ruler of men. I did not need to be told that he was Tardos Mors, Jeddak of Helium. The first member of our party he met was Tars Tarkas, and his first words sealed forever the new friendship between the races.
"That Tardos Mors," he said earnestly, "may meet with the greatest living warrior of Barsoom is a priceless honor, but that he may lay his hand on the shoulder of a friend and ally is a far greater boon."
"Jeddak of Helium," returned Tars Tarkas, "it has remained for a man of another world to teach the green warriors of Barsoom the meaning of friendship. To him we owe the fact that the hordes of Thark can understand you, that they can appreciate and reciprocate the sentiments so graciously expressed."
Tardos Mors then greeted each of the green Jeddaks and Jeds, and to each spoke words of friendship and appreciation. As he approached me, he laid both hands upon my shoulders.
"Welcome, my son," he said, "that you are granted gladly, and without one word of opposition, the most precious jewel in all Helium, yes, on all Barsoom, is sufficient earnest of my esteem."
We were then presented to Mors Kajak, Jed of Lesser Helium, and father of Dejah Thoris. He had followed close behind Tardos Mors, and seemed even more affected by the meeting than had his father. He tried a dozen times to express his gratitude to me, but his voice choked with emotion and he could not speak. And yet he had, as I was to later learn, a reputation for ferocity and fearlessness as a fighter that was remarkable even upon warlike Barsoom. In common with all Helium, he worshipped his daughter, nor could he think of what she had escaped without deep emotion. Chapter 27. From Joy to Death. For 10 days the hordes of Thark and their wild allies were feasted and entertained, and then, loaded with costly presents and escorted by 10,000 soldiers of Helium commanded by Mors Kajak, they started on the return journey to their own lands. The Jed of Lesser Helium, with a small party of nobles, accompanied them all the way to Thark to cement more closely the new bonds of peace and friendship. Sola also accompanied Tars Tarkas, her father, who before all his chieftains had acknowledged her as his daughter. 3 weeks later, Mors Kajak and his officers, accompanied by Tars Tarkas and Sola, returned upon a battleship that had been dispatched to Thark to fetch them in time for the ceremony which made Dejah Thoris and John Carter one. For 9 years I served in the councils and fought in the armies of Helium as a prince of the house of Tardos Mors. The people seemed never to tire of heaping honors upon me, and no day passed that did not bring some new proof of their love for my princess, the incomparable Dejah Thoris. In a golden incubator upon the roof of our palace lay a snow-white egg. For nearly 5 years, 10 soldiers of the Jeddak's guard had constantly stood over it, and not a day passed when I was in the city that Dejah Thoris and I did not stand hand in hand before our little shrine, planning for the future, when the delicate shell should break. Vivid in my memory is the picture of the last night, as we sat there talking in low tones of the strange romance which had woven our lives together, and of this wonder which was coming to augment our happiness and fulfill our hopes. In the distance we saw the bright white light of an approaching airship, but we attached no special significance to so common a sight. Like a bolt of lightning it raced toward Helium, until its very speed bespoke the unusual. Flashing the signals which proclaimed it a dispatch-bearer for the Jeddak, it circled impatiently, awaiting the tardy patrol boat which must convoy it to the palace docks. 10 minutes after it touched at the palace, a message called me to the council chamber, which I found filling with the members of that body. On the raised platform of the throne was Tardos Mors, pacing back and forth with tense, drawn face. When all were in their seats, he turned toward us.
"This morning," he said, "word reached the several governments of Barsoom that the keeper of the atmosphere plant had made no wireless report for 2 days, nor had almost ceaseless calls upon him from a score of capitals elicited a sign of response.
The ambassadors of the other nations asked us to take the matter in hand and hasten the assistant keeper to the plant. All day 1,000 cruisers have been searching for him, until just now one of them returns bearing his dead body, which was found in the pits beneath his house, horribly mutilated by some assassin. I need to tell you what this means to Barsoom. It would take months to penetrate those mighty walls. In fact, the work has already commenced, and there would be little to fear were the engine of the pumping plant to run as it should, and as they all have for hundreds of years now. But the worst, we fear, has happened. The instruments show a rapidly decreasing air pressure on all parts of Barsoom. The engine has stopped. My gentlemen, he concluded, we have at best 3 days to live. There was absolute silence for several minutes, and then a young noble arose, and with his drawn sword held high above his head, addressed Tardo Smalls.
The men of Helium have prided themselves that they have ever shown Barsoom how a nation of red men should live. Now is our opportunity to show them how they should die. Let us go about our duties as though 1,000 useful years still lay before us.
The chamber rang with applause, and as there was nothing better to do than to allay the fears of the people by our example, we went our ways with smiles upon our faces and sorrow gnawing at our hearts. When I returned to my palace, I found that the rumor already had reached Asia Thoris, so I told her all that I had heard.
"We have been very happy, John Carter," she said, "and I think whatever fate overtakes us, that it permits us to die together."
The next 2 days brought no noticeable change in the supply of air, but on the morning of the third day, breathing became difficult at the higher altitudes of the rooftops. The avenues and plazas of Helium were filled with people. All business had ceased. For the most part, the people looked bravely into the face of their unalterable doom. Here and there, however, men and women gave way to quiet grief. Toward the middle of the day, many of the weaker commenced to succumb, and within an hour the people of Barsoom were sinking by thousands into the unconsciousness which precedes death by asphyxiation. Dejah Thoris and I, with the other members of the royal family, had collected in a sunken garden within an inner courtyard of the palace. We conversed in low tones, when we conversed at all, as the awe of the grim shadow of death crept over us. Even Wallace seemed to feel the weight of the impending calamity, for he pressed close to Dejah Thoris and to me, whining pitifully. The little incubator had been brought from the roof of our palace at the request of Dejah Thoris, and now she sat gazing longingly upon the unknown little life that now she would never know. As it was becoming perceptibly difficult to breathe, Tardo Smalls arose, saying,
"Let us bid each other farewell. The days of the greatness of Barsoom are over. Tomorrow's sun will look down upon a dead world which through all eternity must go swinging through the heavens peopled not even by memories. It is the end."
He stooped and kissed the women of his family and laid his strong hand upon the shoulders of the men. As I turned sadly from him, my eyes fell upon Dejah Thoris. Her head was drooping upon her breast. To all appearances, she was lifeless. With a cry, I sprang to her and raised her in my arms. Her eyes opened and looked into mine.
"Kiss me, John Carter," she murmured. "I love you. I love you. It is cruel that we must be torn apart who were just starting upon a life of love and happiness."
As I pressed her dear lips to mine, the old feeling of unconquerable power and authority rose in me. The fighting blood of Virginia sprang to life in my veins. "It shall not be, my princess," I cried. There must be some way, and John Carter, who has fought his way through a strange world for love of you, will find it." And with my words there crept above the threshold of my conscious mind a series of 9 long-forgotten sounds. Like a flash of lightning in the darkness, their full purport dawned upon me. The key to the 3 great doors of the atmosphere plant.
Turning suddenly toward Tartos Moors, as I still clasped my dying love to my breast, I cried, "A flyer, Jeddak, quick! Order your swiftest flyer to the palace top. I could save Barsoom yet." He did not wait to question, but in an instant a guard was racing to the nearest dock, and though the air was thin and almost gone at the rooftop, they managed to launch the fastest one-man air-scout machine that the skill of Barsoom had ever produced. Kissing Dejah Thoris a dozen times and commanding Wooler, who would have followed me, to remain and guard her, I bounded with my old agility and strength to the high ramparts of the palace, and in another moment I was headed toward the goal of the hopes of all Barsoom. I had to fly low to get sufficient air to breathe, but I took a straight course across an old sea bottom and so had to rise only a few feet above the ground. I traveled with awful velocity, for my errand was a race against time with death. The face of Dejah Thoris hung always before me. As I turned for a last look as I left the palace garden, I had seen her stagger and sink upon the ground beside the little incubator. That she had dropped into the last coma which would end in death if the air supply remained unreplenished, I well knew, and so, throwing caution to the winds, I flung overboard everything but the engine and compass, even to my ornaments, and lying on my belly along the deck with one hand on the steering wheel and the other pushing the speed lever to its last notch, I split the thin air of dying Mars with the speed of a meteor. An hour before dark, the great walls of the atmosphere plant loomed suddenly before me, and with a sickening thud, I plunged to the ground before the small door which was withholding the spark of life from the inhabitants of an entire planet. Beside the door, a great crew of men had been laboring to pierce the wall, but they had scarcely scratched the flint-like surface, and now most of them lay in the last sleep, from which not even air would awaken them. Conditions seemed much worse here than at Helium, and it was with difficulty that I breathed at all. There were a few men still conscious, and to one of these I spoke. "If I can open these doors, is there a man who can start the engines?" I asked.
"I can," he replied, "if you open quickly. I can last but a few moments more. But it is useless. They are both dead, and no one else upon Barsoom knew the secret of these awful locks. For 3 days men crazed with fear have surged about this portal in vain attempts to solve its mystery."
I had no time to talk. I was becoming very weak, and it was with difficulty that I controlled my mind at all. But with a final effort, as I sank weakly to my knees, I hurled the 9 thought waves at that awful thing before me. The Martian had crawled to my side, and with staring eyes fixed on the single panel before us, we waited in the silence of death. Slowly, the mighty door receded before us. I attempted to rise and follow it, but I was too weak. "After it," I cried to my companion, "and if you reach the pump room, turn loose all the pumps. It is the only chance Barsoom has to exist tomorrow." From where I lay, I opened the second door, and then the third, and as I saw the hope of Barsoom crawling weakly on hands and knees through the last doorway, I sank unconscious upon the ground. Chapter 28. At the Arizona Cave. It was dark when I opened my eyes again. Strange stiff garments were upon my body, garments that cracked and powdered away from me as I rose to a sitting posture. I felt myself over from head to foot, and from head to foot I was clothed, though when I fell unconscious at the little doorway, I had been naked. Before me was a small patch of moonlit sky which showed through a ragged aperture. As my hands passed over my body, they came in contact with pockets, and in one of these a small parcel of matches wrapped in oiled paper. One of these matches I struck, and its dim flame lighted up what appeared to be a huge cave, toward the back of which I discovered a strange, still figure huddled over a tiny bench. As I approached it, I saw that it was the dead and mummified remains of a little old woman with long black hair, and the thing it leaned over was a small charcoal burner upon which rested a round copper vessel containing a small quantity of greenish powder. Behind her,
depending from the roof upon rawhide thongs, and stretching entirely across the cave, was a row of human skeletons. From the thong which held them stretched another to the dead hand of the little old woman. As I touched the cord, the skeleton swung to the motion with a noise as of the rustling of dry leaves. It was a most grotesque and horrid tableau, and I hastened out into the fresh air, glad to escape from so gruesome a place. The sight that met my eyes as I stepped out upon a small ledge which ran before the entrance of the cave filled me with consternation. A new heaven and a new landscape met my gaze. The silvered mountains in the distance, the almost stationary moon hanging in the sky, the cacti-studded valley below me were not of Mars. I could scarcely believe my eyes, but the truth slowly forced itself upon me. I was looking upon Arizona from the same ledge from which 10 years before I had gazed with longing upon Mars. Bearing my head in my arms, I turned, broken and sorrowful, down the trail from the cave. Above me shone the red eye of Mars, holding her awful secret, 48 million miles away. Did the Martian reach the pump room? Did the vitalizing air reach the people of that distant planet in time to save them? Was my Dejah Thoris alive, or did her beautiful body lie cold in death beside the tiny golden incubator in the sunken garden of the inner courtyard of the palace of Tardos Mors, the Jeddak of Helium? For 10 years I have waited and prayed for an answer to my questions. For 10 years I have waited and prayed to be taken back to the world of my lost love. I would rather lie dead beside her there than live on earth all those millions of terrible miles from her. The old mine, which I found untouched, has made me fabulously wealthy, but what care I for wealth? As I sit here tonight in my little study overlooking the Hudson, just 20 years have elapsed since I first opened my eyes upon Mars. I can see her shining in the sky through the little window by my desk, and tonight she seems calling to me again, as she has not called before since that long dead night. And I think I can see, across that awful abyss of space, a beautiful black-haired woman standing in the garden of a palace, and at her side is a little boy who puts his arm around her as she points into the sky toward the planet Earth, while at their feet is a huge and hideous creature with a heart of gold. I believe that they are waiting there for me, and something tells me that I shall soon know.
This concludes A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs. Return with John Carter back to the Martian planet in the next Martian tale, The Gods of Mars, also produced by Tantor Media. In the sequel, John Carter joins forces with old comrades and forms new lifetime alliances as he battles hostile enemies previously unknown to his people of Barsoom. His adventures ultimately reveal the truth about the gods of Mars. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for our growing library of inspiring unabridged classics by renowned authors. We also welcome you to sample all our titles, listen to author biographies, and take advantage of special offers at www.tantor.com, or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog. We hope you have enjoyed this Tantor Media presentation.